If you just open this like I told you to, tie yourself down to whatever chair you're sitting in because this email is going to be a rough f-ing ride.
Can you make it so every email starts with that?
Welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avergan. It's finally here, the first federal election of 2018. This Tuesday, tomorrow, is a special election in Pennsylvania's 18th congressional district, a district in western Pennsylvania that Trump won by 20 points, but it is a close one. The polls show a tight race between a longtime Republican state representative and a socially conservative Democrat, whose names I won't say now. Listeners, you're going to have to stick around to hear their names. National Republicans are spending. See, I know how to really keep them. Yeah. National Republicans are spending big bucks to defend the district, and Democrats are hoping to notch another upset. So let's talk about it all with our usual crew gathered around the table. Editor in chief Nate Silver. Hello, Nate.
Hello, Jody.
Somehow we've been doing this so long, and it gets more and more awkward every time. Politics reporter Claire Malone. Hello, Claire.
Hey, Jody.
You strapped in. This is going to be a wild ride. And politics writer, sorry, upgrade, and politics editor Micah Cohen. Hello, Micah.
Hello.
Politics rewriter.
That's right.
Whoa! No. Shots fired. Wow.
On today's episode, we're also going to talk about last week's very strong jobs report, the continued debate over steel and aluminum tariffs, and just in general, the state of the Trump economy and what it will mean for him and this midterm year. But before we get to any of that, a question we like to ask from time to time, good use of polling or bad use of polling? And I'll say that I think we're a little conflicted about whether we need to keep doing this. We were debating it in Slack. But if the president of the United States continues to tweet about polls, then I feel like we kind of have to address it and fact check him. So just the latest one is this past Sunday, Donald Trump tweeted, Rasmussen and others have my approval ratings at around 50%, which is higher than Obama. And yet the political pundits love saying my approval ratings are, quote, somewhat low. They know they are lying when they say it. Turn off the show. Fake news.
Lots I love the somewhat low. That.
Somewhat low.
Somewhat
as a quote.
Low. Yeah.
Right. Because he says,
that?
Yeah. Well, he says around 50%, but then gives someone else a hard time for saying somewhat low. But anyway, let's fact check that. There are a lot of facts in there. I suspect all of them are a little off. Micah, you want to dive in here?
Okay. So
Rasmussen and others have my approval ratings at around 50%.
That's probably true. Let's
it's
see
not,
here.
It's
Rasmussen.
Rasmussen's was
I mean, like,
40,
around
44%.
Oh, no, it's not true.
44%.
45% now. That's around 50% in the same way that John McCain came around winning the 2008 general election. He lost by 7 points, right? So Trump is, like, in the Rasmussen poll, 8 points off of, like, a break-even rating. Yep. And so, you know,
and
so
he
President
says,
McCain says Trump is right about this characterization of the Rasmussen poll.
And he says, and others. So worth pointing out here, Rasmussen tends to be an outlier, is that right? And tends to be higher than others?
Yeah, they tend to show better numbers for Trump than other pollsters. I'm just looking through our page.
Yeah.
And 44 isn't...
Zogby Interactive, yes. That's a good one to have in your quiver, at a 48%.
They had a 48. Rasmussen.
Morning consult or consult, I'm not sure which. around 43.
Yeah. And then the other elements of this tweet... Well, first off, this is a chance to tell people what we really look at is the average, right? And that's what we have a tool for on our site. So if Trump is telling us Rasmussen and others have my approval rating, what is actually, you know, that average?
So according to our latest estimate, his approval rating is 40.7%. To compare that to Obama,
yeah,
since Trump brought it up, you know, at this point in Obama's presidency, he had a 49.1% approval rating.
Trump is at around 40, so he's 9 points less than where Obama was at this point. And I'm looking at the graph you have right here. He's never been much closer than that. He's always been 10 or more points below where Obama is so far.
Trump's approval rating has been – his net approval rating has been worse than every president since Truman – for his entire time in office, with one exception, maybe. I think
Ford or Carter, those guys,
yeah,
are, you know, you never know when Ford or Carter has a dip. That can happen. Clinton had some moments where it's
for his
like
first
them.
Term. For so it's compared to that this point in the presidency. Clinton, he eclipsed Clinton at one point, 150 days in, and that's it.
But like also, let's say he had Obama's approval rating, which was what, 48 or 49%. You could characterize that as being somewhat low. Not very low. It's below 50, though.
Right.
And it was enough to get Democrats in a heap of trouble at the 2010 midterms.
A heap of trouble.
Folksy.
So look.
But like the point is, like, you're holding up, Mr. President, a freaking Rasmussen Reports poll that only has you at 50 in theory and actually only has you at 45 as being like the best you can do. I mean, come on, dude. Let's get like a poll that has you at like 57 or something, and then you can brag.
Those polls aren't going to happen.
I know they don't exist, but like, man, that's like pretty thin gruel.
Claire, what'd you make of the...
With all due respect, Mr. President.
Claire, what'd you make of the turn off the show part of this?
What?
I always...
off the show. Like, fake news!
No, of the tweet.
Of the tweet.
Of the tweet, yeah, I'm sorry.
What show?
Exactly.
Like, so, the show that is his Twitter feed? The show that is the news?
No, he ends his tweet by saying, turn off the show, fake news. Which, I guess he was watching television when he tweets, which I guess is something...
I just love that it's like... It's a constant theme, but it's like subtext made text. He's like,
yeah,
don't watch that stuff, guys. Yeah. Come on.
Well, I also love, this is getting a little off track, but that Trump does not watch television in real time, right? They record it for him and show it to him a couple hours later. But then he live tweets that. So everyone's like, Trump is live tweeting television right now. No, he's live tweeting Morning Joe from 4 hours ago. It's just this weird time shifted thing. But let me actually ask a larger question on this. There were a lot of things that Trump tweets which are lies or, you know, deep distortions. But what do we make of this sort of repeated use of polling in this way? Do we feel like it's incumbent upon pollsters to push back? Is there any – I'm just trying to think. Like, is there anything that – is it incumbent upon, say, Rasmussen to say no?
No.
Issue a statement and say, no, you have done – you have interpreted this incorrectly, Mr. President.
No, I don't think that's Rasmussen's job. I think it's, like, our job and other outlets' jobs to – correctly interpret the average of polls and say, like, that's not correct, or contextualize for people what the president's talking about. But pollsters, I think, put out their polls and they want to make sure that they're... I mean, I think it would be a bad thing for a pollster to get dragged into a political fight and then be discredited for the next 2 to 4 years.
In the eyes of partisans. But then do we have to keep correcting this every time?
Yeah, right. See, I'm not having fought wars on the internet for a long time. I don't necessarily...
Are you in Ulysses here?
Yeah. Thank you for your service.
Odysseus.
No one... No
10 years. By the way, listeners, week, the 7th of March, was the 10-year anniversary of 538.com.
Of Twitter fight.
Of Nate fighting with people on the...
You know what they give you for your first, for that kind of stuff? Purple fart.
A purple fart?
Yeah, purple fart award.
My first fighting fight on the internet was with Glenn Greenwald, which I feel like is like...
That holds up pretty well.
Who's one of the people I will not fight with on Twitter.
Uh-huh. Why?
Because he fights dirty.
Okay,
and
let's get back.
I kind of halfway agree with him, and it's like dangerous territory.
But anyway, let's get back to your point about...
I generally believe that like repeating like a false claim, especially when it's like a kind of a trivial claim, sometimes the rebuttal just kind of winds up magnifying that false claim. You know, I think it's also, frankly... Trump is kind of playing on distrust of the polls as a result of, I think, miscoverage of the polls in 2016, and people not understanding that actually sometimes in a close race, as in Pennsylvania 18, the candidate who's narrowly behind is going to win, and that's a pretty normal thing. And so I think until kind of Republicans have an election where they do poorly, as correctly predicted by the polls, then he'll have some traction with that, I suppose.
Okay, but... Just to go one more round on this, even though I kind of think I agree. But if you are doing something that is continually being misrepresented by the audience, and in this case, an audience of the President of the United States, you don't think you need to do a little thinking about that? I mean,
how people
interpret our model.
Shouldn't
Rasmussen say the President is continually using our poll to
Rasmussen
make a
has
false
this
narrative.
Clever strategy of always having a Republican-leaning poll,
uh-huh.
and then in some years, like 2016, you look smart, and then some years, like 2012, you look like dumbasses, right? You know, it's kind of a business strategy. But I don't think Rasmussen is that interested in being the most accurate poll. Like, and I don't say that for, like, that many pollsters. I think like they have had a persistent Republican lean that gets them into trouble in many years, and of course, you know, other years does fine, but they're not that interested in like the actual science of this. But I would say, like, I don't think Trump's claims get that much traction, really. I mean, you certainly see like a lot of citations. Actually, if anything, you see it both ways. You see also in the press, I see lots of references to Trump's like 35% approval rating based on one poll that will come out, Quinnipiac, you know. So I think people actually sometimes are a little lower than the average, too. I mean, Trump could make some arguments. He could say, look, number one, my numbers have improved a little bit. That's true. And number two, if you look at polls of actual voters, registered likely voters, I'm a little bit better than in polls of all adults. And so he can make a couple of like halfway credible claims.
It goes back to what Claire said, I think, which is if pollsters jump into the fray on this, it hurts their – maybe it shouldn't, but it will hurt their credibility.
Yeah, I think it's the job of media to correct it. I don't think it's worth us writing an article about it, but I also don't think it's something we should let them just like have – flying out there without being corrected.
But to Nate's point, like, maybe it's instead of rebutting it, you just say, here's Trump's approval rating.
Here's some advice, kids. Don't let other people frame the terms of debate, right? You're conceding a lot when you let someone else frame the debate.
I would put it a little differently.
Okay, very nice. All right, let's move on and let's talk about the special election in Pennsylvania. So Tim Murphy, who used to hold the seat, resigned last fall after admitting to an extramarital affair with a woman who he allegedly asked to have an abortion. For the record, he identified as a pro-life politician. He was a Republican. The open seat has made for a test of the political waters in what is being characterized as Trump country. I think we want to talk a little bit about, you know, how this is and is not Trump country. The Republican, I told you I was going to tell you the names. The Republican running is Rick Saccone.
Alternate pronunciation, Saccone.
Yeah, okay. I think we know which one of us is going to use that pronunciation for the rest of the segment. And the Democrat is Connor Lamb, who...
Lamb.
Okay. Now you can tune out. Connor Lamb. You've heard the names.
Okay. Okay. Wait, I'm bothered by it's Saccone and not Saccone. Because you know that one of my hidden skills...
The Americanization, I think, is Saccone.
You know one of my hidden skills is to correctly pronounce last names upon seeing them? And I would definitely like lean strongly toward Saccone.
Well, mine is Malone, so you've been mispronouncing the whole time.
What do we need to know about this district, Micah? What kind of district is it?
You just need to play Bruce Springsteen, born in the USA. If Trump is to be believed.
Yeah. I think that's about the Pennsylvania 18.
No, so it's a really interesting district. It's southwestern PA, including Pittsburgh suburbs, but also like some coal mines. It's probably a mix of like suburban and rural. It's red. It's really red. And the fact that we're even talking about it is a testament to how Democratic-leaning the environment is. But it's not homogeneously red, I guess, is what I would say. So it's a mix of, like, Republican voters who Trump overperformed with and Republican voters who Trump underperformed with.
Right. So it's a mix of, like, suburban Republicans who are probably traditional fiscal conservatives and maybe newer Republican voters, those Obama-Trump voters that we often talked about. So people who are maybe traditionally in the 70s, 80s, 90s Democrats.
Exactly.
But have slowly switched over.
And interestingly, I said Trump won by 20 points. Romney won by about the same. I imagine those were the different kinds of Republicans who got that big advantage.
And McCain won by, like, 12 in an election that he lost by 7 points nationally. And so it's been pretty consistent, actually, like, relative to the national trend. It's just been Republican, except, I mean, if you go way back to, like, Bill Clinton, I think I voted for Clinton. But, like, it's neither especially Trumpy nor especially, like,
not
suburban.
Trump-y. Yeah.
It's just, like, kind of a conglomeration, one of those lurations, right?
It's a glom
of various types of Republicanness, at least in presidential voting.
So is it any, can we characterize it as any redder or less red than other districts in which we've seen special elections this year?
So by our index, which looks at the last two presidential elections, putting more weight on the most recent one, it's a 20-point Republican district. So that's about the same as Montana, for example. It's about the same as that South Carolina 5th election. It's less than Alabama, less than the one in Kansas where Democrats came close. So, you know, and you can debate, well, what if you look at down ballot races and so forth? Well, Tim Murphy, the incumbent, didn't even have a Democratic challenger in 2016 and 2014. In 2012, he won by like 28 points or something. So you're like, oh, well, what about down ballot? What about state? I mean, okay. You know, at some point this becomes like special pleading where Republicans or people for whom the spin is in convenient, right? If you're someone who's written about the importance of Pennsylvania to the Trump coalition, Selena Zito, for example, this is a really problematic data point.
Where Internet this, fight.
Where this district that, like, Trump won by 20 points now looks like a toss-up. I mean, that's really problematic because this is her definition of Trump country.
Of the, right.
Whether it's an accurate definition or not, right? But anyway, there are not a lot of good excuses for Republicans to be in an even fight in this district. And although I know the spin will change a lot if Saccone, wins by three or Lamb wins by three. You know, anywhere in that general vicinity of like a Saccone win of 5 points or less, or certainly a Lamb win. I mean, all that's pretty bad. If he got into the mid-high single digits, Saccone, which is, by the way, possible. People don't process how error-prone these polls are in one-off special elections like these. You know, then you'd say, that's not great. That's underperformance, but it's kind of consistent with what we've seen elsewhere. But if he wins by one or loses by four, certainly, or something, that's a big swing, and the excuses for it are pretty feeble on the GOP's behalf.
Let's linger a little bit on this narrative that seems to be out there that this is Trump country. And I think Trump kind of has embraced that a little bit over the, in his rally over the weekend. But Claire, do you think that's a fair characterization? And does the result of this election tell us something about Trump and his coalition more than maybe some of the other special elections would?
So I think the reason why it's being characterized as Trump country, and also why Connor Lamb maybe has a little bit of a chance here, is because in some ways Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh area, like places like Buffalo and Cleveland, are centers of former industrial strongholds. There are also places where unions have been historically strong, and there's strong community ties to unions. And in some ways, I think that kind of that's what people mean when they're talking about Trump country here. It's this kind of voter who has the populist politics that are really popular in the industrial Midwest. I mean, we've talked about Sherrod Brown on this program as being, you know, someone who has these traditional views about tariffs, about the way that the U.S. economy should favor American industry. And those Trump policies that he's now, in the past week, professed loving, these tariffs, that plays well in some place like Pennsylvania 18 because of a long history with American manufacturing. But it's also the unions are turning out pretty strongly for Connor Lamb and pulling their political weight and saying, listen, this is your guy. What has Trump done for you? Vote for Connor Lamb. He's a, you know, he's a nice Catholic boy who, you know, is personally pro-life, but blah, blah, blah. You know, like there's a way to spin Connor Lamb in a way that's friendly to a voter who's maybe crossed over to the Republican side because they feel culturally out of touch with Democrats, even if they might agree with, you know, union Democrat politics.
Right. The district certainly includes Trump country.
Yeah.
I mean, it like literally borders West Virginia.
Yeah, it's Appalachian. I mean, it's Appalachian, Pennsylvania.
And you also have some nice suburbs. That's why it's a weird, like, kind of incoherent district.
Yeah. Right.
It's got the exurbs, basically.
Yeah. But it does border West. I mean, like, literally, if you – someone should do this. If you, like, did a map, like a heat map of all stories that pitch the Trump country storyline and, like, where the datelines from those stories were,
I think that
heat map would center on or around Pennsylvania 8. You know, some mix of Pennsylvania, you know, Kentucky,
18.
West Virginia – and Ohio, Pennsylvania 18. Yeah, I think literally you would end up like somewhere in that
you just
district.
Have to track J.D. Vance's Google Maps and you'll just find that heat map, I think. But can we get back to Lamb and how he's positioning himself? Claire kind of hinted at the fact that he's a centrist. We used to talk about these centrist Democrats. I don't know if that's a useful term
Blue
right
dogs.
Now. But is that really kind of what he is? And is this a sort of traditional play where like, okay, it's a deeply red district. Well, let's throw out our most centrist Democrat and that's how we're going to get success?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, he's like, he's full stop. No, he is not running the type of campaign you saw in like Georgia 6 by what's his face?
Ossoff.
You've already forgotten his name.
Ossoff ran as a
blank slate.
But like a kind of mainstream Democrat, or even, you know, Doug Jones in Alabama ran as pro-choice.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this is a more, I don't know if old school is the right term, but
yeah.
it's an old school Democratic playbook where you tack to the center on abortion.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't come out all the way for Trump's tariffs, but he kind of supports the idea.
He sort of reminds me of, and he's also, I think, importantly, in a new flavor strand to this Blue Dog thing, is he's come out and said, I don't really support Nancy Pelosi as Speaker, which I think is becoming a big way for people to push, Democrats to push back who are running in these more conservative districts. I often look to someone like Tim Ryan, who challenged Pelosi in the leadership election, who represents Youngstown, who actually is pretty progressive himself, but he sort of frames himself as a Blue Dog and is supporting a lot of these candidates. I'll also point out my one last little thing is that Connor Lamb also shares a certain biographical profile with a lot of Democratic candidates who have been quote unquote successful in mm-hmm. recent months. And I say quote unquote successful because some of them have lost. But I'm talking about someone like Jason Kander, Connor Lamb. They all have military service in their background. Someone like Seth Moulton, who's a rising star. And I've written about this before, but they're a certain younger white man who is able to couch progressive politics. You know, maybe we'll accept Lamb a little bit from here, but couch progressive politics for more moderate or Republican districts. And that's, I think, an interesting thread to talk mm-hmm. about and an interesting biographical detail.
And is there anything in that play with this district specifically? Is that basically a play for I'm going to get these suburbs of Pittsburgh and I'm not going to get the northern Appalachian part of this district, or is that an appealing kind of Democrat for even for quote unquote?
I mean,
Trump
this is
country.
Kind of the conventional wisdom about what you should do. It is a strongly Republican district in the last several presidential elections and the last several congressional elections. So you run to the center. It's not that complicated. I think,
but there's plenty.
Like,
but the last couple of years have shown a lot of argument within the Democratic Party about whether that's the right move. And
yeah,
instead, you should run
like,
to the left. I think a lot
like,
of people would argue, right?
Yeah, but you can walk and chew gum at the same time, which I feel like a lot of Democrats
well,
would recognize.
Well, I feel like people are mistaking signal for noise. What's
oh.
the what's
oh,
the,
brand is strong.
Amazon.com.
HarperCollins. Actually, I don't know who your publisher is.
Penguin.
Penguin Press.
If you build models that tries to account for ideology in different ways, which is a little tricky to do, especially for someone who hasn't run yet. But, you know, you'll show that it has an effect of maybe 2 or 3 points either way in terms of vote margin, which is meaningful but not huge. It can definitely be outweighed by other factors, including environmental factors. And so it's a little bit like, I'm really going to get myself in trouble, like detecting the signal for, like, climate change or something amidst, like, wide variability from race to race, and it's like usually swamped by other things. But you'd probably rather have a Connor Lamb than someone else. Well, Ossoff was weird because he was kind of like demographically fit like the woke progressive Dem, but like was trying to like be milquetoast. And like I mean, I do think but it's also like people just kind of have this lazy habit of explaining whatever residual relative to their expectations by the candidate was good or the candidate was bad. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I do think that like Connor Lamb is on the spectrum of being a stronger candidate, and Ossoff was not terrible, but a mediocre candidate, and that probably matters at the margin. But like, there are way too many excuses that Republicans are making for having all these results where Democrats way overperform previous outcomes in the district. And it's different in every race, right? You know, that race in South Carolina where Democrats came close and district that's really Republican, that was like, it's really low turnout, which is true. But here you have what's expected to be pretty high turnout and have a similarly big or maybe even larger overperformance. In Alabama, it's Roy Moore. Yeah, you can definitely make some excuses for Roy Moore. But sooner or later, if you have 5 or 6 different excuses for 5 or 6 different bad races, Virginia, it's like, it's the suburbs, right? It's the suburbs and wealthy suburbs, you know, but the opposite of where we're seeing elsewhere. And so the fact is that the environment as manifested in these elections is really bad for Republicans, right? Tomorrow will tell us, is it really, really, really bad or merely really bad, you know? But these special elections have been a terrible indicator for Republicans. I guess, fortunately, like, they would rather take the generic ballot or something, which is also a pretty good indicator and shows only an 8-point Democratic lead, which sounds like a lot, but actually might not be enough for them to take the House.
But do you think, Nate, that – so, okay, on the special election results, we look at the results as a group, right, rather than any one thing. But it seems like a lot of Democrats are looking at this race as a test case for whether a Lamb-type candidate and a Lamb-type campaign can succeed in these districts. Is that overwrought, too, because it's just one
Probably,
election?
Probably, yeah. I mean, what you can do, again, looking at, like, anything that becomes, like, a second-order thing, right? So the first order is just how do you do relative to some reasonable expectation? And we use presidential results for that, right? If you have now, this is the 7th or 8th or something, right, counting?
Federal election.
Federal election, yeah. Right? That gets to be a point where it can be meaningful for a first-order effect. But then trying to, like, discern within that, which types of races are more of this or less of that, that becomes trickier. The one thing we have learned by also looking at the data set of state special elections, which is dozens and dozens, is to say that some of the areas where Democrats are bouncing back the strongest are not necessarily in the suburbs, right? They may be places where they deteriorate a lot in 2016, you know, the places where they're doing really well in, like, state special elections are, like, Oklahoma and Missouri and, like, Wisconsin and places like that that actually shifted quite strongly toward Trump. And that's easy to explain. It's, like, based on reversion to the mean. You know, here, again, you have a district that's, like, a mix of kind of Romney and Trump Republicans. It's about evenly mixed between them. And so you might not learn that much about the district. But I don't know. I mean...
So let's keep going and talk about Rick Saccone here and what we need to know about him, and then we'll talk about the state of the race. Micah, you want to take a crack? What do we need to know about this guy?
Nothing, really.
Really?
He's a Republican. Yeah.
But is he a Trumpian Republican? I mean, we talked about the two types of Republicans in that district. Is he a Trumpian Republican? Is he a more suburban Republican? Is he being embraced by Trump? I mean, Trump's out there, right, and saying...
Yeah, I guess
he's trying to brand himself as a Trumpian.
He was Trump before Trump, he said.
Yeah.
He was Trump before Trump was Trump. That's the exact quote. I'd put it this way. I don't think he has any distinguishing features that should color our interpretation of the race.
So
does that
no,
make sense?
He's no, the generic ballot right. Republican.
Kind of.
There's no Roy Moore factor. But he's also not particularly going to sway it because of a particular feature of his.
He's the Ossoff of PA-18.
I think that might be right. So maybe the more interesting.
Let me say something.
You want to jump in on this? Go ahead.
Unlike Ossoff, he's actually held elected office before. He's a longtime member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, which is just to say that like that's a pretty traditional credential.
Mm-hmm.
And you can debate like personality and policy positions. Maybe he's a little bit too far to the right on social issues relative to what you'd want. But he is like a credentialed politician and not someone who you heard particularly much griping about until 3 weeks ago when polls suddenly began showing.
But I guess that's my point. It's like if you're trying to explain the results of this election, either beforehand or afterhand, I don't think Saccone should be on your list of explanations.
Okay. Now, one thing about him, though, that is getting a fair amount of attention is the amount of money that he's raised. He has not raised that much money, and the GOP has kind of come in and thrown a lot of money his way. What do we make of that phenomenon? And, Claire, do you think that's like a good move on the part of the GOP to inject a bunch of cash into this one race?
Well, I mean, I think they're freaked out about losing it. So they want to, because it's the president doesn't handle those losses well, and then it spins into a national story. And I think if Lamb wins, it's going to be a national story no matter what. But you already see Republicans, even as they put money into the race, sort of trying to do the softening of the ground and say, well, he might win. He wasn't that strong of a candidate, that sort of thing. And so you can tell that they're a little freaked out about the bad press that this race, that losing this seat would bring, basically.
And I think it's safe to say that Trump, if Saccone wins, Trump will take credit. If he loses, Trump will do the, he was going to lose by 10 and he only lost by 3. And that's because I jumped in and tried to help him, but he was beyond help.
This one's one of the harder ones to spin. I mean, if you win, that's the thing. If you win, to explain to people that like winning by 1 point when you should, quote unquote,
it's
win
hard
by 9, that's hard. I mean, half the political press doesn't understand how fractions work.
What would happen?
So
Nate?
It's hard, you know, but like a loss here, I think, is hard to spin. I mean, it may not matter in the end. Someone pointed out to me on Twitter, I was saying, yeah, Democrats have been really bad about the expectations game in these special elections.
They're losing this one.
Yeah. People,
what do you mean they're like losing the expectations?
The conventional
game?
Wisdom has become that like Lamb is going to win this thing.
I know.
Comfortably.
Although let me again point out that the conventional wisdom is espoused by like reporters is ahead of what it should be based on the polling. You know, this one Monmouth poll came out as we were broadcasting that had Lamb up 6.
I was just looking for that, yeah.
Well, but they also
Had what? Go ahead.
They had Lamb up 6. They also used like 13 different turnout models, and so, you know.
That's the new thing pollsters are doing.
Yeah.
And Nate read all 13 while we were here having a conversation.
But if you look at the average of polls and kind of have priors of Republican district plus noisy, messy polling, you know, it's within the realm of
Nate Silver
50-50.
Predicts Saccone win. Nate, what would your
but
reaction?
Like, but here's the thing, though. Jonathan Bernstein, friend of 538, was like, okay, you're right, Nate, the Democrats have done an awful job. Nate and Micah, you're right about the spin wars.
And Claire.
But does it really matter?
Got him sitting right here.
Because look at, like, candidate retirements and recruiting, right? Where maybe actual members of Congress are like, you know what? I can tell that it's really bad news that Democrats are coming close in all these districts, even though they haven't won anything except for Alabama. I don't know, right?
It's maybe not it like, doesn't matter.
Maybe it doesn't matter as much.
How would you guys react if Saccone wins and tomorrow Trump tweets like, hey, everybody, I know Saccone won by three, but this is a really red district. And so relative to the partisan lean of the district,
we have to get it together.
Disappointing.
Yeah, we'll see. But so let's talk about the polling. I mean, I mentioned that it's a dead heat, but has there been enough polling for us to get a picture here? Or is this one of these sort of local elections where there isn't a ton of attention?
I mean, I don't know if anyone's even bothered to calculate polling average. Maybe if you
excuse me, Nate. The preview we published today, which does not have the Monmouth poll, let's add the Monmouth poll in real time. But the preview today by Nathaniel Rakich on our site, 538.com,
had
the average 46-46.
So toss in Monmouth, and it probably goes to, you know, a 1.5-point lead.
I'm going to calculate an average here in real time, people.
But don't double count Monmouth, because it's probably in the previous average.
Oh, so just take that out?
Yeah, you can't cheat. 2.5 points for Lamb.
Is what?
That's the new average?
Including the Monmouth poll. We just updated
Replacing
our average.
Replacing the old Monmouth poll with the new Monmouth poll gets you 2.5 for Lamb.
Okay.
2.5 is in that annoying range where it's like just on the fringe between saying, oh, it's treated as a toss-up, and hey, you know, I would say Lamb's a little bit ahead based on the polls. But anything from like a 6 or 7 point Saccone win to like a 10 point Lamb win would not be that surprising given the history of House special election polls being not very accurate.
I'll say as we wrap up, we have a great preview on the site. You can go read that now to get you all up to speed. And can I just actually point out, you guys mentioned 538 all spelled out. You know how you, because we don't own 538.com, so you got to do it all spelled out. Well, a very clever listener of the podcast tweeted at me last week and said, you should purchase the URL 538 all spelled out, because we say that on the podcast.
Wait, all spelled out?
No, like the 538-ALLSPELLED.com, which I now purchased and own.
Oh, my God.
I bought it.
Jody's going to make his retirement money on that.
So,
Nate, sell it to Nate.
The bidding is open. If you want 538-ALLSPELLED.com, because we say it on this podcast all the time, people are confused. They need to go to the site. I own it, so just make me an offer.
But wait a second. 538 and 538-ALLSPELLED.com is not spelled out.
That's correct. 538 all spelled out.
Think about that, Claire.
Oh, you
want
to
buy that one?
You want to buy 538 all spelled out?
That's my nest egg, everyone.
538 all spelled out.
All spelled out.
Yeah.
Okay. But you can go to 538allspelledout.com right now. You can see the site that I built, which redirects back to our podcast page. So up next, Trump last week signed off on steel and aluminum tariffs, to the consternation of many Republicans in Congress. We're going to talk about that and the Trump economy overall. But before we get to that, this week's podcast is brought to you by SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe is a home security company that you probably started hearing about on this podcast back when they were a startup. Well, today they have transformed into the fastest growing home security company in the nation, protecting over 2 million people. We did it. I think that's entirely because of this podcast. And they just released their brand new home security system, the all new SimpliSafe. The system has been completely rebuilt and redesigned. They've added new safeguards to protect against power outages, downed Wi-Fi, cut landlines, bats, hammers, and everything in between. I don't know which kind of bat that is, that fly or that hit. Probably both. The all-new SimpliSafe was redesigned to be practically invisible with powerful sensors so small you'll hardly notice them. But you know who will? Intruders. SimpliSafe spent years building this system, and they added so much in this all-new version. But you still get the same fair and honest price and 24/7 protection for only $15 a month with no contract. It's smaller, faster, and stronger than anything they've built before, but supply is very limited. Visit SimpliSafe.com/politics right now to order. That's SimpliSafe.com/politics to protect your home and family today. Once again, SimpliSafe.com/politics. This week's podcast is also brought to you by Kronos. No one compliments you when their paycheck is correct, but one mistake and you risk alienating your entire workforce. With Kronos, you can make sure your payroll is done right the first time from punch to paycheck. Embedded checklists, simplified workflows, and a single source of truth. HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping are all unified in one system, all with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. And when it comes to regulations, well, you know, if you own a business, that it's harder than ever to keep up with today's evolving alphabet soup of regulations, MLA, FLSA, ACA, EEOC. I just read all those. I think I recognize one of them. Anyway, Kronos will help you out. With Kronos, you can minimize compliance risk and track HR policies, making sure they are applied consistently and fairly. Learn more. Help your business right now. Kronos.com. That's K-R-O-N-O-S. Kronos.com, workforce innovation that works. Okay, back to the show. Let's talk a little bit about some economic news and then the larger economic picture and how it affects Trump. There's been some items in the news, a very strong jobs report last week. Also last week, Donald Trump sort of acted upon his pledge to enact new tariffs on steel and aluminum. There's still some questions about what kind of exceptions will be in there. But it is a fairly rosy economic picture. I said it slowly, which indicates that I'm treading on thin ice there. But, Nate, let me ask you the sort of big question first, and then we'll get to the details. But should President Trump be getting credit for a relatively strong economy, and is he getting the right amount of credit?
Do I look like former 530 economics correspondent Ben Castleman?
This is more a political question than an economics question.
A little bit. I think the economy is good.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere between good, like a third of the way to very good, but good, right? I think the press maybe doesn't spend enough time talking about the economy and how it affects people's lives. I think, do presidents deserve credit for economic performance? That's, I think, a debated question, especially just a year and change into his term.
Mm-hmm.
But look, this is one of the two for the House. There are two big saving graces Republicans have, one of which is the way districts are drawn means they could lose the House popular vote by 6 or 7 or 8 points and still be very competitive for having the majority of seats. And two is the economy. I'll put it like this. If the economy was crappy, Republicans would be in a catastrophic position electorally. It certainly gives Trump something credible to talk about, to say, hey, we have added lots of jobs. We have increased wages. The stock market is doing well, though it's dangerous to always brag about the stock market. So, yeah, I mean, like, look, this is a big plus for Trump and Republicans. I don't get into the question of, like, how much credit does presidential policy deserve for the economy.
Yeah, and that I think our former colleague Ben Castleman is very good about reminding us that presidents maybe don't have a ton of effect, but it's still a political factor.
I mean, the conventional wisdom actually says that the relationship between the economy and midterm voting is only moderately strong.
Okay.
So it's not like the presidential years, where it's a little overrated in the presidential years anyway, where it's strong but not, like, as deterministic as some people who overfit models think it is.
But it is certainly, like, the main thing on his side right now, right?
It's a driving force, and I think why people support him, why certain Republicans support him. But I think the reason why there's so much focus on the economy is because there hasn't been, because it's a strong economy, because the one legislative accomplishment that Trump has under his belt is this tax cut bill that was a big deal, and that's something that the Republicans want to run on in 2018. And so that's kind of the thing that they've got going for them, right? There's not a lot of other stuff that Trump is pushing. Like, what happened to Infrastructure Week? And it's so, yeah. But the danger of it, of course, is that stock market is doing well right now, economy is doing well right now. But a lot of people are saying, listen, the U.S. economy is due for a downturn sometime in the next couple of years. Or, you know, what happens? Well, and then it's like, what happens then? And that's why people are a little bit wary of owning the stock market too much as president.
No, and that's what was really interesting to me about the tariff stuff is, like, Trump and Republicans have a really good story they can tell on the economy. They passed this tax cut bill. It gets, I guess we're going to get to this, but, you know, the bill gets way more popular after it passes. The economy's doing well. So, like, all else being equal, if I were a Republican or if I worked in the White House, I would not f*** with the economy.
If it ain't broke.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So I was surprised that they did.
But the
you know who else was surprised? Gary Cohn.
Yeah, true. But the tariffs issue, we discussed this a little bit last week, is a sort of classic Trump political or economic stance. And so it's maybe not that surprising that he reverted back to that.
No, that's not surprising. We always knew he supported tariffs. It's just surprising to me.
Before the midterms.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he supported a lot of stuff that he hasn't done anything on.
Yeah, well, when you encounter – I remember an encounter I had at the – Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas.
Ooh.
Right?
with a robot?
Consumer Electronics Show. We're talking to, like, some kind of moderate Republican business people. And they're like, yeah, we had mixed feelings about Trump. But the fact is that Trump is very motivated by the stock market. And he's not going to do anything that upsets our kind of people, basically. And this was in contradiction to that.
Right.
Look, you could also argue that, like, the tariffs are kind of a half measure.
They're going to get watered down.
Canada and Mexico, other people who are friendly, you might exempt. And so, like, it's a little bit more symbolism, which, by the way, is a consistent pattern with Trump, right? It's kind of the subheadline is often less dramatic than the headline, you know, and these tariffs are probably not enough on their own to substantially disrupt the economy. I mean, it might have an effect at the margin, and then a trade war can escalate. But Trump often kind of feints or not bluffs in a direction, takes a half measure, and then people, because the narrative about Trump is what it is, assume this is the first domino to fall.
Yeah.
And often he just kind of pulls back. You know, we saw over the weekend with the meeting with North Korea where, okay, you know.
But let's stay on tariffs because I think that's really interesting, this sort of notion of the tariffs as a political stance more than maybe an economic policy. But then the polling was really interesting. I mean, it came out and it was generally unpopular.
Well, there was some disagreement in the polls. Wait a second. Morning Consult found 40% of registered voters supported the tariffs, right? That is higher than Marist, which asked a slightly different question, but Marist found 27% of people thought the tariffs would help the economy, 42% thought they would hurt the economy, and Quinnipiac, which found, I think, the most anti-tariff result, which was American voters opposing the tariffs 50 to 31%. So that's kind of in order of pro-tariff to anti-tariff. Morning Consult, most pro, then Marist, then Quinnipiac.
And all of them are in the like 5 to 10 to maybe even higher, 15 or almost 20, you know, against. So, I mean, was I wrong in characterizing that Americans tend to be opposed to these tariffs?
Well, Republicans are pretty supportive of it. In the Political Morning Consult poll, 65% of Republicans support versus just 24% of Democrats.
So Republicans are on board.
Yeah.
Not overwhelmingly.
Yeah, but it's interesting because it's also, I mean, this is, tariffs are not a traditional Republican policy, but it's obviously a Trumpian policy. So in some ways, it's an interesting tilt towards, you know, we were asking this question a year and a half ago, will the Republican Party become Trumpian? I mean, I don't know. This poll is a certain, like a little whiff of how people's, Republicans' views are colored by the president's views on a pretty non-traditional Republican policy outtake.
Look, there are two polls that show the tariffs are quite unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
There's one poll that shows they're slightly popular, and that poll is often an outlier on questions such as these. So in the absence of more polling, I think we would say this is not a terribly popular move by the president.
And then to follow on that, and sort of to Claire's point, do these numbers maybe tell us more about Trump than they do about tariffs? Meaning, if this had been the first thing that Trump and engage in a thought exercise with me. If this had been the first thing that Trump had done, day one, 2016, do we think these would have been more popular because they are that kind of Trump red meat? And the fact that they are less popular now, does that tell us something about maybe people are just pushing back against anything that Trump supports because he's an unpopular guy?
I do think that.
That they'd be more popular because they'd have more time to gestate?
No, just because they would have been right off the bat. Trump, you know, was riding
would have
high.
Been a bigger shock.
I'm not sure.
Or they
because
would have
the travel ban was the one kind of radical thing that he did right away. And I'm not sure
point.
That particularly.
Yeah. You could have lost the Republicans who are now with him because, you know, he's doing a lot of like traditional Republican economic things.
Oh.
But if he'd done tariffs right off the bat, people have been like, what is this?
So the Republican Study Committee, which is a conservative group within Congress, took like a straw poll. And I think like 85% of their members were opposed to the tariff. So it kind of cuts a little bit awkwardly against the base. I mean, it also has, again, as I said before, I'm not sure the magnitude of these is really enough to, like, have a big effect on the economy. You also kind of don't want to do things, though, that hurt the economy. And so, I don't know, people tend to, like, think everything is some, although this has decreased, frankly, but, like, for a while there was, like, oh, everything's a brilliant 13-dimensional chess move by Trump. I mean, some things are just kind of dumbass things that, like, aren't necessarily fully thought through and are kind of half measures, like I said. And I think, you know, there have been reporting for a while that he was kind of itchy to do something on tariffs. And maybe it reflects like a kind of sincere policy belief on his part, rightly or wrongly. But I think he also just kind of gets bored and wants to say, okay, here's this button over here I haven't pushed. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because like the Republican tax law has really improve. I mean, it's not like wildly popular now. The Real Clear Politics.
Well, I would push back against that too. I think that tax law is getting a little bit too much. It's still kind of unpopular, and so the notion that like this has brought like a revival for Republicans, I think, is like actually not usually consistent with the evidence. But
no, I don't think.
Let's lay out that evidence because that's where I think we should start to move to the tax bill.
So the Real Clear Politics average has on average 42% of people approving of the tax law now, 45% disapproving. That's a net of -3 percentage points. That is significantly improved from when the bill passed.
It bottomed out at 22
points.
It bottomed out at 20 points underwater at one point, and now it's 3. When we were covering the tax bill, though, Claire, we sat here and said, this is very unpopular right now, and we don't expect it to get more popular. And it has gotten more popular.
Yes.
Isn't that a notable trend?
Yeah, I mean, it's good for Republicans as far as 2018 go, because this is something that they're counting on campaigning on. And if you're, you know, that generic ballot Republican candidate, you're excited that the tax bill is playing well, that people are saying, all right, like, this is one thing that Trump is actually following through on, and the state of the economy bears things out. So, yeah, it's good news for Republican candidates.
But the timing of, like, so the generic ballot, for example, improved for the GOP and now has begun to decline again. The timing of that lines up pretty oddly with the tax bill, where the improvement didn't take place until like a month after it had passed, and then began to revert again towards some type of long run mean or whatever, right? And so, like, so people are looking at, if you look at the data carefully, it's not clear that there is much of an effect.
So let's end where I think we touched on it a little bit, but Micah, you know, this notion of the economy and electoral performance being strongly correlated. We've talked about that a million times on this show. We don't have to get, you know, we'll probably do a proper segment on that going forward. But do we have any indication that this year will be a year that continues that trend or bucks that trend? Or is that still to be seen?
I would guess that all else being equal, it would continue that trend. Do I think Trump will underperform what the economy suggest? Yeah, I think he probably will, because he's such an outlier in other respects. But I still think the economy will have a will be a big influence.
And so for Democrats, I don't know what the if this is a sort of improper way to phrase it, but is the strong economy, Claire, a liability, and perhaps the biggest liability for Democrats going into the fall?
Well, it's certainly, I don't know. I mean, I think the Democrats are still, as we've talked about a lot, the Democrats are going to campaign on a sort of anti-Trump line. But I think the fact that they're still struggling to come up with, like, what are Democrats, like, what is it specifically that Democrats were saying to people, like, is bad about the tax bill? I don't think American voters have a good idea of what that is. I mean, yeah. Democrats' whole argument is, like, it's bad for people in the long run, blah, blah, blah. But they haven't given that to people in bite-sized nuggets. And so, in some ways, I guess hindsight being 2020, it makes sense that there's some sort of leveling and greater approval of the tax bill for, you know, from voters.
Well, and Democrats have smartly, I think, just moved on.
Moved on. Yeah.
Is that smart, though? I'm not sure.
I mean, part attacking of the tax bill?
Yeah, maybe. Because Democrats kind of dropped their attacks of it when Republicans made more vigorous defenses of it. I mean, part of the issue is that Democrats were making arguments about, like, earlier versions of the tax bill.
Right.
And in the 4 or 5 versions they had, they did eventually make it so that more middle class people were getting at least a little something. Whereas, like, the early versions, you know, was, like, purely neutral for the middle class. They made, you know, so it improved as a political measure, maybe as a policy measure, too, over the course of the debate. But to the broader question about the economy, I mean, look, the economy is the first thing that Trump would want voters to talk about. And whether the tax bill is somewhat unpopular or somewhat popular or very unpopular, you'd still rather include that as part of the conversation, and probably even include tariffs as part of the conversation, if it means you're talking about the tax bill and not Russia or North Korea or corruption or Stormy Daniels or whatever else.
Okay, let's end it. Nate Silver, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jody.
Claire Malone, thanks to you.
Thanks, Jody.
And Micah Cohen, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer, and Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us, podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. You can visit us at 538allspelledout.com, where you will find a link.
Or 538allspelledout.
allspelledout.com, which we will soon be purchasing. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store. When you leave a rating, it helps our rankings, which helps others discover the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.